Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, November 10th. President Trump's fight for re-election and to remake the government in his image with any remaining days in office are not over. He fired his defense secretary yesterday, as you probably heard, really for not being loyal enough to Trump or to military bases named for leaders of the Confederacy. The FBI director, who declared white supremacists the number one domestic terror threat, may be next. Trump got his attorney general, William Barr, to tell all U.S. attorneys they can look for voter fraud without any evidence of any triggering an investigation, as would normally be the case. Barr's chief election fraud deputy resigned last night over what looks to him like politicization of the Justice Department. Now, Democrats might see the post-election period as President Trump's zombie political campaign continuing to haunt, risen from the dead to file lawsuit after lawsuit, threatening to suck the blood from democracy by getting states to reject the voters' will without evidence of voter fraud. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell sees it like this.
Obviously, no states have yet certified their election results. We have at least one or two states that are already on track for a recount. And I believe the president may have legal challenges underway in at least five states. The core principle here is not complicated. In the United States of America, all legal ballots must be counted. Any illegal ballots must not be counted. The process should be transparent or observable by all sides, and the courts are here to work through concerns. Our institutions are actually built for this. We have the system in place to consider concerns, and President Trump is 100% within his rights to look into allegations of irregularities and weigh his legal options.
So the networks are calling Joe Biden president-elect, but we remain in an uncertain moment. With us now, Zach Montalaro, who covers voting for Politico and writes their newsletter, The Morning Score, and Fred Kaplan, military columnist for Slate. His column is called War Stories. His latest book is The Bomb, Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War. Zach, welcome, and Fred, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Zach, I'll start with you. That Mitch McConnell clip, not from a campaign bus, but from the Senate floor. Is that a new signal of how much support Trump's attempts to nullify the vote count without evidence of voter fraud is starting to get?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's a signal that Republicans will ultimately stick with him through the end of this process, but it is at least a signal they're sticking with him now. You know, the Senator Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is right that campaigns do have a legal right to seek these things, but I just want to stress how extraordinarily unlikely it is that any of these actions will overturn anything. I believe as of this morning, Vice President, or rather President-elect Joe Biden, has passed Donald Trump's margin in Pennsylvania. They're not particularly close in Michigan. In a state like Georgia, which remains uncalled by most media outlets, Joe Biden is ahead. In a state like Wisconsin, the margin's big there too. You know, all these things that these campaigns can seek, they're entitled to do so, but the margins at this point are larger than what Hillary Clinton lost by in 2016, and she conceded the election the next morning.
But let me pursue the paranoid line here, Zach. The newest lawsuit from the Trump campaign in Pennsylvania actually seeks to prevent the certification of the election based on process, not any demonstrable or demonstrated fraud. Can you describe on what basis?
Yeah, so the newest lawsuit in Pennsylvania that the Trump campaign filed, I believe last night, maybe in the afternoon, time's a flat circle, basically does what you says it does. It's not alleging widespread massive fraud in the state. It's just saying there was a two-track system that mail votes were treated differently than in-person votes, so they shouldn't certify the results. That is a remarkable thing for a presidential campaign to file. I'm not downplaying that. But at this point, what are the odds of this actually going anywhere in the courts, right? I have not seen any argument from anybody who's not directly connected to the Trump campaign, even incredibly prominent Republican lawyers, saying this is anything more basically than a press release with a filing fee attached to it. So it's things like this. Yes, the Trump campaign is absolutely, you know, attacking, you know, democratic norms. They're undermining faith in the election. But will this actually succeed in court? I haven't seen anybody yet who thinks that they really have any much of a snowball's chance of doing so.
Right. Well, every guest who's come on so far without an agenda has said that. In normal times, we could take that as very likely predictive of the outcome. And yet I think it's shocking to many Americans learning for the first time how much power the state legislatures have over certifying or not the election results as counted by the poll workers. You're a journalist, not a lawyer, but how much can you clarify what a Republican legislature in Pennsylvania could do if they want to, for example, just because they have the power and might stand up even after an unsuccessful court filing and say, no, we really don't know what Joe Biden's margin of victory is because the observers aren't close enough to the ballots to see them?
Yeah, you know, I think in Pennsylvania specifically, there's actually a state law that mandates that the electors go to the popular vote winner. So that removes a lot of the authority from the state legislature to do so. In fact, I think the state Republican state legislative leaders, because it's a split government there, Democratic governor, Republican state-controlled legislature. The legislature leaders even said, you know, reaffirmed that we don't have a hand in appointing electors, that in Pennsylvania, the state, it goes to the popular vote winner as, you know, certified eventually by the state. You know, the state legislative leaders there already announced that they're going to try to audit the results. I don't think we really even know entirely what that means. But the path for any state really to kind of overturn the popular vote is incredibly, incredibly, incredibly slim. I want to stress that over and over again, that I think the real danger with these cases is not that it'll somehow change the results of the election, that Joe Biden's president-elect, I suspect he'll be president-elect in a week from now. It's how much does this chip away at trust in the system and create more long-term damage?
Fred Kaplan, people don't generally know much about Mark Esper. Why did Trump fire him as defense secretary yesterday?
Well, Mark Esper became Secretary of Defense about a year and a half ago, and initially he was as kowtowing a lapdog to Trump as any official. In fact, Trump himself started mocking him, calling him Secretary Yesper. But then after June 1st, that incident during the demonstrations over the killing of George Floyd, and when Trump roped Esper and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff into posing for him, posing with him for an op-ed outside St. John's Church across from the White House just after police had scattered protesters in Lafayette Square with tear gas. That's when he flipped, and he started saying things like he would not approve using the Insurrection Act to bring active duty U.S. troops into the streets. He started criticizing Trump's objections to changing the names of the 10 U.S. Army bases in the South that are named after Confederate generals. you know, he just started standing up. Trump has made it clear for quite a while that he would probably fire Esper. It was published a couple days ago that Esper had written a letter of resignation and put it in his drawer. And I think primarily, I think Trump was, this was an act of pure spite, that Trump was firing Esper before Esper could resign. On the other hand, there are some things to be concerned about. If, and I don't think this is going to happen, but if Trump were in the mood to launch some kind of attack on somebody in his final desperate days, these orders go through the Secretary of Defense. Esper probably would have slow-rolled it, and I don't know what his replacement, Acting Secretary Christopher Miller, would do. He would have to consult with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They would know that they would be held accountable if something went south afterwards, and they could maybe put it off by calling it an unlawful order. But then there are other things going on as well.
Before we go to other things, you just dropped a little rhetorical bomb in there about possibly a physical bomb. Before we get further into other things or to the new guy, Christopher Miller, and who he is, you said if Trump was in the mood to launch an attack. This is the guy who ran on disentangling us from foreign wars, or at least not getting us involved in new ones. Who would Trump attack as a lame duck president?
Well, again, I don't think it's going to happen, but I do know that there are military people, serious military people, worried that he might do something in Iran. Probably not North Korea these days. He still thinks Kim Jong-un is a good friend of his. But just something to mess things up for his successor. Again, I think it's highly unlikely, but he does have the ability to do that, and if he wanted to, it would go through the Secretary of Defense, who is no longer a person that Trump had considered a member of the resistance. So there's that. Let me just say, people in power are genuinely worried about this. I'll just say that.
Genuinely worried about Trump starting a war between now and January 20th.
Yeah.
There's a scenario where the firing of Esper as defense secretary might become related to contesting the election. Esper opposed sending in federal troops to quell violent protests or looting in Portland, as you mentioned before. But Ron Suskind had a dystopian scenario piece in the New York Times about how the election disputes could prompt violent unrest on whatever sides if it gets hot enough. And then Trump could deploy the military. And I guess that leads to some form of martial law in his attempt to nullify the election or stay in office. And that would have to go through the defense secretary. Are you familiar with that scenario?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a little far-fetched, but I mean, what that's happened in the last week isn't far-fetched. I mean, I don't know. Every time I say, well, I don't see that happening, sometimes it happens. One thing, though, or one result of Trump's attempt to send out troops to active duty, military troops, to quell the protests last June was that some military officers who usually don't think about such things because they're not supposed to started thinking about the propriety of presidential orders. General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, apologized for appearing with Trump at the photo op outside the church. There were lots of National Guard units where there was active discussion among the troops about whether this was a good idea to do this. If Trump did this, aside from the direct effects of putting troops on the street like that, he would be unleashing what could amount to a constitutional crisis within the U.S. military. I mean, these, you know, I've heard theories that McConnell is doing this because he really has his eyes on the Senate runoff race in Georgia in January, and he wants to keep the base all riled up for that. That may be true, but these guys, I mean, they are unleashing. They are fanning the flames. They are playing with fire. The long-term implications of rally, look, he knows this is nonsense, but rousing, say, 80% of the Republicans out in the country who believe that this election is fake, this is going to have, just tremendously unsettling implications for going ahead and really resolving a lot of the very serious and not at all partisan crises that we're facing as a nation in the next few years.
You know, Fred, when we were kids during the Cold War, we used to think that it would be the generals who would take too much power and the civilian leadership, meaning the presidency, that needed to keep them in check. Now it looks like the other way around, like the generals are the ones with level heads who actually respect the Constitution, who somehow have to keep the president in check.
Well, you know, even as long as a decade ago, I remember hearing that, you know, some of the biggest doves in the Pentagon are generals. Most of these guys really don't want to go fight wars that they don't have to fight. They've done that. You know, again, when you and I were growing up, there hadn't been a big war for quite a while, and the big war was the good war, right? So they were prepping for that. But since then, there's been Vietnam and Afghanistan and Iraq. Most military people, it's usually the civilians who get us wrapped up in this kind of nonsense.
And with Fred Kaplan from Slate, who covers the military, and Zach Montalaro from Politico, who covers voting. Gloria in Somerset, you're on WNYC. Hello, Gloria.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I understand Republicans wanting to please Trump all the time because he appeals to their base, who, you know, who's also the base for Republicans. But why are appointees, why do they seem so afraid of Trump? They just seem to want to please him and keep him happy and just seem so terrified of offending him on any level. What is the worst he can do? He can fire them, and they already know that's coming.
Fred, can I give that to you?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, you know, what's happened in the last 4 years is that Trump has fired or accepted the resignations of just about every independent cabinet officer who is there. About a year ago, he said, I'm now getting the kind of cabinet that I want, which is basically a cabinet full of loyalists. There aren't, you're right. I mean, it is kind of insane that, you know, everybody's in a cabinet position now could easily go out and get another job someplace. Their livelihood does not depend on dealing with this guy. But these are lapdogs that he has working for him now. I can't think of anyone in a position where his or her resignation would really set off fireworks who's inclined to do it. They're loyal by nature. What bothers me even more, I think, is in the Congress. I think three or four Republican senators have congratulated Biden on his victory. I mean, an election just happened. These guys aren't facing an election the day after tomorrow, not for another 2 years or 4 or 6 years. The fact that they are still shivering in their boots about this guy, or maybe just liking everything that he does, that's concerning me even more. I think we're seeing the collapse of institutions that are supposed to protect us from this sort of thing.
With the two Senate runoffs looming in Georgia, with control of the U.S. Senate at stake in how they come out, the two Republican candidates are calling on Georgia's Republican Secretary of State to resign. So there's a Georgia version of the attack on institutions, the attack on the perception of the integrity of the vote. In this case, being lobbed by the two Republican candidates for U.S. Senate in Georgia against the Republican Georgia Secretary of State. What's up with that?
I would say your guess is as good as mine is what's up with that. I think probably the most telling part of what they did was that they didn't actually allege any specific cases of irregularities. They didn't allege any problems. They just said, well, there was problems. By and large, there hasn't been problems not only in Georgia, but countrywide. This has been a remarkably smooth election considering we're in the middle of a pandemic, and that pandemic has gotten, frankly, a lot worse over the last month or so. So it's the same thing. It's kind of what the president is doing on a state level that, you know, Republicans didn't necessarily get the result they wanted. The Republican senators didn't get the result they wanted. They're both heading to a runoff, and the president didn't carry the state. So they're attacking the Republican Secretary of State without providing any sort of evidence of what he did wrong. Of course, Secretary Brad Raffensperger, the Republican, said he's not stepping down. He took a pot shot at Senator David Perdue, you know, saying, I would be upset, too, if I was also in a runoff that I shouldn't be. But it's the same thing. It's what the president is doing. It's attacking democratic norms. It's attacking the democratic system without any sort of evidence to back it up.
Before we run out of time, Zach, what's the significance of Attorney General Barr telling all the U.S. attorneys last night that they may go ahead and look for voter fraud? Aren't they already able under the law to prosecute voter fraud as U.S. attorneys?
Yeah, I think this was maybe a slight tweak of policy that he's saying, you know, normally we don't open these investigations until, you know, after the election is certified. And he's saying if it's big enough, basically you can do it. I will readily own up to not being the most in tune with the DOJ's in and outs of policy on this, but I think but maybe the most concerning part with this is that the career civil servant, the career attorney who overseen the election crimes branch of the public integrity section of the DOJ resigned from his post after Attorney General Barr announced this. So, you know, that was, I think, the thing that brought up the most concern, that even if this is at best a messaging play to the president's base saying, look, we're looking for this voter fraud to be clear, we have seen no widespread evidence of it, is that career civil servants within the DOJ who would know this best are resigning rather than kind of sticking by the policy.
Yeah, when I first saw the Barr thing, I thought it was more rhetorical than anything else, since U.S. attorneys are able to investigate voter fraud. And he's saying, don't forget, you're able to investigate voter fraud. I thought the nuance there was that the trigger for some kind of investigation was being, the line for that was being moved from somebody has to present you with some credible theory of something, like normally somebody has to present a prosecutor with something before they go poking around to see if it's true. In this case, he seemed to be emboldening them to just go poking around. So I don't know how big a difference that is. But then his number two in charge of actual voter fraud investigations resigned in protest. So he must think it's serious. Fred, did you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I mean, I was alarmed initially. Then I looked at the full quote. And in fairness, he did say these allegations must be, you know, credible and not just going around chasing stuff. And then he released a subsequent statement saying, I did not mean to suggest that there are any such allegations right now. So mm-hmm. I don't know if he's just playing both sides. And I also read, I think the Daily Beast today, that the White House, that Trump is very upset with Barr's statement because it didn't go far enough. So huh. I don't know. There are a lot of, I think there are some people trying to play both ends of this thing. But again, yeah, the initial take on Barr's remark is, oh my God, he's going to corrupt the election, and this just creates such mayhem out in the world. And by the way, not just the American populace. If you're talking about dealing with the rest of the world, and one theme that Biden has played is that he's going to go to our allies and our adversaries and say, hey, you know, we're back. The Trump years, we're just an anomaly. We're now going to support democracy. We're going to stay true to our allies. We're going to deal with threats. If I'm out in the world and looking at the United States right now, I say, well, okay, glad to have you back. Glad to hear these words. But I don't know whether to believe you. Half the country seemed to vote for this guy. There's all this mayhem going on. You know, you could imagine writing a news story about this, Brian, if it were happening in another country. You know, it would be like covering a banana republic or something. And so the allies have got to be thinking about this point. Okay, Biden is saying this. I've known him for a long time. I know what he's about. But how much is he really reflecting the United States at this moment? And are the American institutions solid enough that we can count on them again, or do we have to go find our own alliances from now on?
We will give the last word in this segment to listener KG on Twitter, and you will be glad to hear how your words resonated. It says, the guest on Brian Lehrer's show just now compared Trump to Harold Hill in The Music Man. That's the only take I really needed to hear today. So we thank Zach Montalaro, who covers elections for Politico, and Fred Kaplan, who covers the military for Slate and is author of The Bomb, Presidents, Generals, and the Secret History of Nuclear War. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.